relationships are critical in Washington. But how do you A, find out who the key players are, and B, figure out how to reach out to them? Well, I want to tell you about Leadership Connect. It's been an absolute lifesaver for us as we expand our operations and outreach here at Washington Tech. Leadership Connect, it's the digital service used by top federal contractors and government affairs leaders to contact decision makers and develop those strategic relationships. Visit leadershipconnect.io and join the community. I love it, and I'm 100% sure you will too. That's leadershipconnect.io. Try it now.
The same ethos, the same network, the same young people are still being sort of targeted and monitored and watched. But I think a lot of this is playing out on social media.
Welcome to the Washington Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed on the move in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the Washington Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
Lawmakers grapple with backup plans for educating kids without internet access and mail-in voting. Amazon shuts down its warehouse in Queens after an employee contracts COVID-19. And Jeff Lane is my guest. Hey, everybody. Lawmakers and educators are considering how to provide internet access to children who don't have it as the coronavirus pandemic intensifies amidst crippling uncertainty as to when Americans will be able to come out from under house arrest and when schools will reopen. On the federal level, Federal Communications Commission Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel has been underscoring the need for universal access. Democratic Senators Klobuchar, Peters, and Tester urged the FCC in a letter last week to take actions to ensure that parents at least know about the options that are available to them for accessing high-speed internet service if they need it. Federal Communications Commission data indicates that some 21 million Americans do not have access to the internet at home. Senators noted in their letter that some 12 million children lack access to the internet at home. We here at Washington Tech have been advocating on the local level here in the D.C. area for stronger partnerships between groups like the National Parent Teachers Association and school districts to develop buddy systems that pair students who lack access with students who have it. Several Democratic senators are proposing mail-in ballots ahead of the 2020 presidential election. Under the bill, the National Disaster and Emergency Relief Ballot Act, NDEBA, all voters would be entitled to obtain absentee ballots. The bill also provides for 20 days of early voting in all states. A new Brennan Center study found that maintaining the credibility of the U.S. electoral system during the pandemic, which would include measures outlined in the NDEBA, would cost taxpayers some $2 billion. Amazon has shut down its Queens warehouse after an employee tested positive for coronavirus. The shutdown will be temporary, but if one goes down, many can go down. And then what? An Amazon spokesperson told The Hill that the employee is under quarantine and that they sent their employees home with full pay. The company also announced that it would stop shipping non-essential items to warehouses in the U.S. and U.K., and that it plans to hire another 100,000 workers to handle the spike in demand. The Associated Press reports that more and more children who were detained at the border and separated from their parents are not only having to face immigration judges alone, usually without counsel because they're not entitled to it, but now they're going to have to face them through video screens. The AP piece describes seven children standing shoulder to shoulder in Houston, talking to a judge located 1,000 miles away on a glitchy video link. Nearly 4,000 children are currently in federal custody. A number of those children cross the U.S.-Mexico border alone. Finally, you know there's a ventilator shortage. Well, Elon Musk has said that his company would produce ventilators in the event of a shortage in hospitals. Just last week, Musk said coronavirus concerns were dumb. So it's good to know he's come to his senses. You can find links to all of these stories in the show notes. Stay with us.
global policy. This is the Washing Tech. Tech Policy Podcast. Serving the world.
My guest today is Jeff Lane, Assistant Professor of Communication at Rutgers University. He studies communication and technology as it relates to urban life, criminal justice, and social inequalities. He approaches these topics ethnographically by getting to know the same people and situations in person and online. Lane is the author of the award-winning The Digital Street, Oxford University Press 2019, a neighborhood study of social media use in Harlem. It's the first book about neighborhood street life in the digital age. Please welcome Jeff Lane. So let's start with hearing a bit about your research area, Jeff, generally, and what sparked your interest in this particular area?
Yeah, well, I've always been, I think, interested in urban life and cities and some of the inequalities that play out in cities. And, you know, I grew up in New York. I think like you, Joe, I've spent a lot of time in New York and seen some changes in it. And I've always been interested in how young people are having very different experiences based on their race, based on the neighborhood in which they come of age. And I'm especially interested in how inequalities and issues in cities play out on the internet as well, and what it means to be connected to a neighborhood and connected to a community online and offline, and what are some of the issues that come up there. And I'm also really interested just in like the challenge of doing fieldwork and doing urban studies, and particularly this kind of tradition of like ethnography, where you go and spend time with the community and you have a set of relationships and you write about people's lives by having spent time alongside them. And then, you know, you've got people whose lives are playing out through their phones and through social media. So some of what you're kind of there to see in the neighborhood is also playing out on the internet, and things that are happening online are shaping people's reputations and experiences. So just trying to kind of like update and think about urban life and communities online and offline, and what are some of the issues there. So that's kind of broadly what I'm interested in. And then I've got sort of another kind of thread of research on what happens when social media becomes criminal evidence, and how social media factors in the criminal justice process, and what does it mean to make decisions about young people, particularly young people of color, based on their online traces as well.
So tell us about your book, Jeff. Fascinating book, by the way, you know, released in November. It's entitled The Digital Street, Oxford University Press 2019. Tell us about it generally, and then we'll do a deep dive, because it's fascinating, and I want everyone to hear about the overview first.
It's a book about the digital side of a neighborhood and how that shapes the experiences of Black teenagers in Harlem, at least the Black teenagers that I happen to spend a number of years with. And it's based on, you know, field work with young Black folks with really multifaceted lives who were facing some of the predicaments of street life, both in person in the neighborhood and then also on the internet with each other and with the police. And the first part of the book is really about how teenagers facing and confronting street life, how they use their phones and social media, like, you know, Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, to manage the risks in their lives and also the opportunities. And then the second half of the book kind of shifts to the adult world and sort of looks at, you know, how do the adults in their lives relate to them online and use their visibility online to help them, to serve them, to punish them. And then I tried to think a little bit about intervention and try to come up with some constructive ideas and think a little bit more about, you know, what do we do when you see sort of poverty on the internet? How do you respond? So it's a book about what I'm calling the digital street that social media kind of opens onto for young people who are going through street life, and then for the adults in their lives, the outreach workers, the pastor, the cops, the defense attorneys, the prosecutors. How do they do what they do with young people now that they also have access to them through technology?
How did you do the field work?
I was a graduate student in sociology, and I was looking for a dissertation project, and I met a pastor. I met a pastor in Harlem who I met him by chance, and I was just taken by him right away. He was a really charismatic figure and was kind of a major player in the sort of political life and the social life of Harlem. And he struck me as unusual because he had this really large Twitter following. This is back in all the way back in 2009. He had this Twitter following of maybe, you know, 1,500 teenagers in Harlem and the Bronx that he was connected to on Twitter. And then he also had this sort of face-to-face, you know, existence in the neighborhood as well. He was he worked at a senior citizens home, actually, where he was a service provider. But he had in that job a kind of clubhouse and drop-in space for young people. And then he was out on the street making trouble, as he used to say, you know, calling attention to issues, calling out politicians, calling on journalists to respond to issues in poverty. And then he also had this kind of, you know, fantastic kind of communication system where he was connected to the teenagers on Twitter. And then he was connected to the adults in the community, some of their parents and service providers through text messaging. So if you could imagine in 2009, you wouldn't find a lot of neighborhood adults and parents on Twitter, but they were comfortable on their phone and through text messaging. So he was kind of moving information between the sort of teenage world and particularly the sort of street world of young people going through violence and experiencing police violence and neighborhood violence. And he was kind of going between the sort of online world of young people and the phone lives and phone world of the adults, and trying to mobilize community members to come out to get involved in situations he was worried about, whether that was a fight or someone in the community in need. And so he had this kind of like incredible sort of online and offline intervention program that I was really taken by. And then I started to you know, work with him and find a place alongside him. So he was kind of a gatekeeper for me, you know, and I'm a white guy in my 30s, you know, in grad school. And he sort of opened up a world to me that I wouldn't have probably otherwise had access to. And then, you know, the challenge when you do these kinds of projects too is you also have to have your own relationships. You know, you don't want to just be like a pawn or an extension of that person that so graciously lets you in. So I also, you know, I lived in Harlem for a number of years and worked as an employment counselor, and I organized basketball games, and I set up a computer lab, and I tried to figure out, you know, ways in which I could be useful and productive in the lives of the young people that I was coming to meet, and also in, yeah, just trying to sort of have my own relationships and my own sort of standing as well. And so I've been really getting to know a group of young people who are now in their mid-20s, you know, and pushing 30, some of them, and have seen their lives kind of evolve and change over going on 10 years now, and have seen their social media use change too, and have seen them sort of, you know, evolve into young adults on and offline. And that's really been the work that I've been involved in. But I owe it all to this pastor, and I kind of started with him, and then did my own sort of project, starting from there.
So how'd they treat you when you're up there? You mentioned you're a white guy in your 30s. Did you feel like you were welcome in the community? Did you have instances where that you reflect back on that you were sort of eye-opening?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of doing field work is standing around like an idiot for a long time, for months even, and then gradually feeling more comfortable and building a little bit of trust and rapport. And a lot of it is also just inside yourself and coming to have some confidence in what you're doing and feeling like there's a way to kind of go forward. But, you know, I would say I was met with a lot of love eventually and with a lot of respect, and I felt really fortunate to have a place in young people's lives, and to get to kind of cross the color line in our world, and to get to understand some of the experiences of black teenagers. Not for a second did I think I was a black teenager, but, you know, I felt like I, you know, came to get to know people and their families and get to know their everyday lives. And I spent time with young people in some of their schools. I spent time taking young people. We did a series of college trips. We went to community colleges. We went to Howard. We went to Wesleyan, where I went to undergraduate. We had a number of experiences that I think, even given our distances, allowed us to find some kind of common ground. And and that was pretty cool. I think at a certain point in the beginning, I was seen maybe as a cop because I'm white. I don't think I look like a cop too much, but totally get that, right? I mean, I think for a lot of the young people, their interaction with white people are as cops and teachers, you know? So why would I be any different? And I think that also gets back to this pastor, you know, and how you have to kind of start with someone in the community that can vouch for you, you know? And then just by being consistent, you know, just by being there, by spending time with people, by breaking bread, by showing up regularly, I think you get past some of that suspicion and some of the distance. Then again, you know, you never know the nature of these relationships also, and you never know totally what people think of you when you're not around. But I'd like to think I had some really good relationships, and they're certainly ongoing. So,
did you start rocking a pair of Tims?
I mean, I tried to dress like myself, you know. They would have called me on any efforts to try too hard. but I appreciate your call out to the Tims too, because you know I did grow up in '80s and '90s New York. You know, the Tims were a staple of that.
Exactly.
Still are.
So now tell us about how else they're experiencing their youth. Like you mentioned, I grew up a couple blocks south of Harlem, depending on what you consider Harlem, right? Grew up on 96th and Columbus at a very different time. We're talking about the 70s, the 80s, early 90s. So witnessed the Central Park Five era. In fact, our precinct was the 24th precinct, which was where the defendants were picked up. The defendants who've since been exonerated, of course, where they were booked. And you know what I'm noticing as I listen to some of the language of kids today is that it really hasn't changed much since we were kids. Yeah, I'd love to hear about what you're seeing after having studied this issue, and how is social media sort of playing a role there?
Yeah, the context of New York in this time is sort of interesting too, because you know, maybe as you say, things haven't changed on one hand all that much for kids in Harlem. And maybe the surrounding environment has changed more. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, we went from a time in New York that had a great deal of gun violence and you know, we're sort of, there was just much broader risks of crime to, you know, a city that's become, you know, largely safe and prohibitively expensive for all but the few that can sort of pay to live in New York. So I think, you know, what's kind of interesting is we have these kinds of pockets, right, of entrenched poverty and violence that have endured. And so, you know, when I was doing this study, it was the Obama era. It was sort of the expansion of the Harlem Children's Zone. It was a new district attorney taking over after a previous district attorney had been around for, you know, 30 something years. And, you know, this district attorney and the sort of focus was on these kind of, you know, remaining sort of pockets of poverty and violence that, you know, go together, right? And so there was just a lot of kind of focus and attention on that. I found that a lot of it was, you know, a kind of criminal justice response, and it wasn't a sort of even keeled, distributed sort of social services approach, right? It wasn't sort of based on, okay, these are hot spots for services and care and for all our sort of love and attention. They were hot spots for crime, and they were treated as such and policed really, really heavily. So, and in some ways too, you know, and this has been said by other sort of scholars that, you know, the one of the kind of consequences of a sort of safer New York is that these areas where there is still suffering and where there is still violence become almost more obvious, and so it's easier for police to kind of focus their resources and attention there too. So just the kind of context, I think, for New York is sort of important. And then it's during the same time that sort of social media comes to permeate, you know, all aspects of life, you know, and becomes a sort of a part of young people's everydayness. We see, you know, social media become accessible through phones and the adoption of smartphones and all. So I think just to have a group of young people that are around each other in the neighborhood, but also through social media, that have grown up, you know, in chat rooms and, you know, on, you know, BlackBerry, AIM, and then have sort of moved to, you know, MySpace and Twitter. So just the opportunity to be around your peers, to interact with them, to study them, to see their lives, to kind of preview and even possibly displace some of your meetings in the neighborhood, you know, online, right? The fact that you can kind of follow someone or reach out to someone on the internet before or after you've met them in person, I think that's kind of a new sort of phase. You know, if you think of boys and girls meeting on the street, you know, they know each other already on the internet. They've already kind of played some of this out before. They've already seen each other in photos online. They've already had some kind of digital history. And then they meet or they don't meet, you know, and then there's a kind of an on and online life to this kind of relationship. So that's, I think, really significant. I also think, you know, one of the things that really stayed with me was just the importance of girls in neighborhood life, and that when you sort of see the physical space of a neighborhood and you think about sort of street life and you think about how that's talked about and written about, it's usually focused upon boys and young men as being the kind of most visible and the most sort of dominant figures. But when you go online, you really sort of see the centrality of girls and the power of girls in neighborhood networks. And what I mean is that, you know, girls in Harlem had the broadest social networks. They had much broader networks than the boys, and they were the ones who had the most important kind of information on gossip and possible violence and problems, but also on resources and opportunities and programming. And so girls were sort of like the cut points and the sort of brokers of communication throughout the neighborhood. And that was something that really stayed with me. And I think that by being, you know, online and offline with young people, I was able to really appreciate that facet of neighborhoods a little bit more.
That's fascinating. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to learn a little bit more about the interaction between these kids and police and prosecutors. Stay with us. Justice system generally, Jeff. You know, my wife is a former Manhattan assistant district attorney, and I tend to look at these issues more from the perspective of a defense attorney. So we have those types of debates about criminal justice, and particularly around interventions and the efficacy or inefficacy of things like stop and frisk and the broken windows theory. But, you know, we're talking early 2000s, and it was a completely different era. You know, we're talking before Facebook, and, you know, when people were still using AOL for email. Your work picks up later after that Morgenthau era. And I'm interested in learning about what you're seeing, and as much as, you know, how are teens using technology, and how does it overlap with the criminal justice system?
Well, you know, I was seeing, I kind of jumped in when, you know, young people had already grown up with some social media in their lives and were, you know, having their sort of interactions on the internet, having, you know, photographing and posting videos of their friendships and their relationships to their family and really all parts of their lives online. And then I was also sort of seeing, you know, stop, question, and frisk first expanding and sort of peaking, and then being, you know, curtailed significantly after it was deemed unconstitutional in 2013, or at least unconstitutional in the form in which it was being deployed. So there was, you know, both during the period of my study, this big sort of spike in stop and frisk, and then this really sort of significant drop, at least in the official statistics and counts. And so one of the things that I came to think about was like, well, you know, the same neighborhoods, the same networks, the same young people are still being sort of targeted and monitored and watched. But I think a lot of this is playing out on social media, and that, you know, really it's a lot sort of easier and makes a lot of sense from the police perspective, right? To, you know, follow young people on social media and to, you know, access their lives and their networks and their friendships and try to make sense of them on the basis of their YouTube channels and their social media accounts. And a lot of these platforms too, at least in the early going, that, you know, particularly low kind of security and would be pretty easy to kind of access the entire contents of a photo album, or, you know, just the sort of, there's just a lot of opportunity, I think, to collect photographs, to collect posts, to collect network data on young people in a very sort of simple way, right? Without sophisticated social media tools or anything. And what I saw was, you know, police, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, all kind of learning how to adapt the things they do to the internet through these young people that I was studying. Like, they were their training data, so to speak, you know? So the sort of detective is kind of learning how to, you know, identify and label groups as gangs based on their online traces, based on the kinds of posts they put up and the things they say and do in photographs or in videos. You know, the prosecutor is learning how to bring criminal charges on the basis of social media activity. You know, the judges are making sense of admissibility on, you know, based on social media. Defense attorneys are trying to defend their clients based on having new access to them online and based on the things that they say and do on the internet. And I think that's just really a sort of a major kind of piece of how the criminal justice system, you know, is evolving, you know, and it's something too where it's like you've got the sort of the young people who are usually the first adopters of these technologies, and you've got their really, you know, nuanced, complicated worlds, right, of young people. I mean, it's really hard to understand young people, right, and understand their peer dynamics, and yet you get a real sort of slice of that online, and you get tremendous access to young people online. You get kind of a front row seat to some of what they're going through and what they're experiencing, and yet it's, you know, it's just a slice, and it's very curated and it's very strategic on the part of young people. And then you've got, you know, folks who are trying to advocate for or punish or support young people, you know, making sense of them and making decisions on the basis of their online communication. So I've been really interested in sort of understanding how that's played out and how it's evolved. And also the kind of feedback, you know, as young people become aware of the fact that police are in their followings and that police have potentially friended them online by, you know, posing as a party promoter or posing as a neighborhood girl. And the fact that some of the things that have been said and done on the internet have become evidence, you know, and so there's a feedback effect. You know, young people are aware of this, and so they begin to speak differently and change their communication, or they go dark on the internet altogether for a period of time, or they try to communicate more privately. And so this kind of cat and mouse game that has long played out on the street plays out on the internet as well, plays out on social media too.
And we're talking about witnesses as well. So it's not just people who are being investigated or for whom there's probable cause. We're also talking about intrusions into some of the witnesses.
That's right. And I mean, I think one of the interesting and I think concerning elements that I ended up really thinking a lot about was how conspiracy law lines up with social media. And, you know, conspiracy law, you know, is based on the idea of being able to establish connections between three or more people and then connections to criminal intent or criminal planning. And social media is really good for that, for meeting the kind of legal requirements of conspiracy, because what it does is it shows connections between people, right? All sorts of connections. It makes connections between people visible, right? Through tagging people with photographs or people appearing as friends in a friends list. All the different ways in which social media makes connections visible, right? That's really useful as a prosecutor, right? To have evidence of connections. Of course, the nature of that friendship, the nature of that online tie is really variable, right? And it depends on the nuances of the community and the nuances of the people involved, right? I mean, like, you're going to be Facebook friends with the people who live in your building, the people in your classes, the people in your sports programs, And that could reflect some people who are involved in gang activity, and it's going to reflect people who have nothing to do with it, and it's going to reflect people who are, you know, located closely geographically in the city and socially. And so, you know, how do you parse that out, and how do you use that material in a responsible way, I think is such a challenge, you know? And then the other part of conspiracy too is some kind of like indication or intent to do something criminal, to move forward with a crime. And that's tough too, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of what's said online is based on, you know, very sort of strategic and curated versions of ourselves, and it's based on the art that we consume and the music that we consume. And so to talk about, you know, guns, to talk about violence, to talk about drugs, I mean, that's a part of our culture. That's a part of what, you know, what people talk about, right? But if you have that kind of connected to your online history, and if you post about that, you're exposed, you know, depending on the other factors as well. And so I think you have young people who are growing up now with the expectation of being under surveillance in their neighborhood and then through social media. And dealing with a lot of different audiences and a lot of different people watching or thinking about them, their peers, their family members, cops, maybe mentors, outreach workers. And so they're kind of like having to juggle all these different versions of themselves and all these different identities. And, you know, like everyone else, we're all evolving and changing, particularly when we're in our teenage years. So it's just really complicated stuff, you know, and I've wrestled with that a lot.
What are some final ideas you'd like to leave with us before we close, and where can we find you online?
Well, I think, you know, just the importance of seeing the whole person. When we have access to people's lives online, I think in many cases we kind of forget about the rest of their lives, the rest of them, beyond the sort of slices or the little bits that we get on the internet. And, you know, whether that's, you know, just the post that someone put up there, or even more dramatic incidents where, let's say, there's like a fight video, I think we tend to, you know, forget that whoever was involved in that fight video, they have, you know, a really rich, complicated life in their neighborhood, in their community, at their school, wherever that fight happened. It's not just entertainment for them. Their life and their reputation and their relationships are going to change, you know, after that video. And so just remembering that, you know, whatever slices we get of people, it's an incomplete picture, and that people are, you know, are just whole, complicated persons. And so being able to kind of remember that, I think, is really important. You know, I think just like thinking about how we can respond to the visibility of poverty, you know, as it becomes more visible on the internet, and how can we do things beyond, you know, punish? How can we, you know, find new ways to support and, you know, look out for young people who are struggling, right, when their struggles are visible online? So I think that's something that we should be thinking about. And I'll just kind of leave that there as one of the last thoughts. And then you can find me on Twitter at The Digital Street. That's a very selective version of myself, right? An incomplete, impartial version of myself, but that's my academic self. And you can certainly find me there. And you can get the Digital Street book at wherever you get books. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it through the publisher, Oxford University Press. If you want to support a business in the Bronx, I now live in the Bronx. There's a great bookstore that is for young people and for educators called Boogie Down Books. So boogiedownbooks.com. Thanks. Yeah.
Jeff Lane, Assistant Professor of Communication at Rutgers. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the chat.
That concludes episode 223 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Week 2. How are you holding up? You okay? You have enough snacks? Make sure you get enough exercise. Get out there, take a walk. 10,000 steps a day is still the rule. You can do that in the morning. Do that. Don't just sit around in front of the pantry. Look, I'm good. guilty too. I've been doing it. My snack of choice has been Oreos and Twizzlers on the lockdown. But it's got to stop. It's got to stop. Take care of your families too. I know you guys must be, have to be getting on each other's nerves throughout this. And if you don't have a family, if you're single, you can stay plugged in to sources of media that make you feel good. I hope this podcast makes you feel good. That's why we do it. It's not just about tech policy. It's about community and making the tech policy conversation more inclusive, something you don't find much of in Washington, whether the engagement is online or offline. That's the environment we try to create here. In any case, I guess that's it. I'll see you back here next week with a brand new guest. And hang in there. A lot of uncertainty right now, but we're all in this together. So take care of yourselves. By the way, remember the recipe: hand sanitizer, isopropyl alcohol, and aloe vera. That's the recipe. You should probably know already because all the alcohol and aloe vera is now gone from the supermarket. I'll see you next week. Take care.